Hello and welcome to the Exotic Pet Collective, where we talk about tarantulas, scorpions, inverts, and all pets exotic. I am your host, Richard. You may know me from my YouTube channel, The Tarantula Collective. And today we have a special guest joining me to discuss conservation, mantises, isopods, and more. But first, this week's episode is brought to you by thetarantulacollective.com. If you're looking for that perfect gift for the tarantula keeper in your life, head over to thetarantulacollective.com and pick up some Tarantula Collective t-shirts, beanies, hats, or hoodies. There are also stickers, posters, face masks, prints, and all kinds of other tarantula and invert-related merch. While you're there, you'll also find care sheets, a list of reputable tarantula and exotic pet dealers, exotic pet enclosures and supplies, discount codes, and some helpful resources. Find all things tarantula and exotic pet related and stay connected and up to date with everything happening in the collective by signing up for the mailing list so you'll receive the collective newsletter. That's at thetarantulacollective.com. Today's guest grew up in a ranch in Idaho where her father encouraged herping, and she would collect mantises from her mother's garden. She recently graduated with a degree in environmental sciences and minors in ethics and food studies from the University of Oregon. She keeps isopods, roaches, mantises, tarantulas, and reptiles, and is the owner and operator of Arthropod Ambassadors. Please welcome to the show, Erin.
Hey, Richard.
Hi, Erin. It's nice to finally meet you face-to-face, virtually. Well, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, you're very welcome. It's amazing to be here.
All right. So you have, let's make sure I get this right. You have a website called Arthropods Ambassadors, and you also have an Instagram and a YouTube channel all under the same name. Is that correct?
Yep. Yeah, we started out, I got the ambassador idea from working with birds and seeing the place I worked with really had a respect for the animals and use them as ambassadors, not just as the usual animal zoo sort of setup. And so I started the idea of having ambassadorship for insects because we just have amazing animals. And I wanted to catch tarantulas and a couple other groups in there. So Arthropods fills that out. But we've got a website that's mostly just what I have too much extra of in my collection up for sale, as well as some care sheets. I'm working on care sheets. I really want to take care of an animal for a while and before I write that stuff up. But yeah, and then also Instagram's my main focus. It's the easy way to just have photos that are amazing and easy to reach a larger audience. I just put up a Facebook just to be there, but I don't work with Facebook very much.
Facebook can be quite toxic. I don't believe.
Yeah. It. Yeah. Facebook's its own animal.
Yeah. So you're currently out on the West Coast, right? You're out in Oregon.
Yep. Eugene, Oregon, a little bit north. We've got Portland, and then it's easy to get down to California. So, and it's close enough to the coast. It's pretty temperate weather. It's got a couple snowstorms every once in a while, but not too much for weather extremes.
Yeah. So where did this fascination with arthropods begin? Like how did you even get into this hobby?
I was the kid at recess that was looking through under logs and trying to find whatever was nearby. Maybe didn't get to eat lunch very early because I couldn't wash the goo that comes on. If you pick up a slug, they've got the mucus, and I found out it stays on your hands when you wash them really, really hard. So I was definitely that kid in kindergarten that the teachers were pulling off and trying to get her hands cleaned up. And I don't know, they're just amazing. Every single one of them is so different, just the anatomy and their lifestyles and life ways. So there's just a little interest in every single species, no matter what your interest is. So I just feel like they reach a large audience if you really look at how diverse they are.
Yeah. Currently right now, like what all's in your collection?
Mostly cockroaches and mantises that are actually really closely related. I didn't realize it until I got my first hissing cockroach, but they really kind of have that mantis face. And then as I did more studying, they're the two closest related on the like life tree of arthropods.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I know that.
It's kind of, I hook people by getting interested in mantises, and then suddenly they realize that mantises are pretty much just predatory cockroaches. and then the cockroaches also just have so many different biological examples that you can show with them. So they're really nice for a teaching aid. So I got a lot of cockroaches, a couple different mantises. I went to a pet expo in Albany nearby, and there were mantises for sale, and got my first orchid because everybody has to get their first orchid. And then got some ghost mantises, which I highly recommend in comparison to orchids, even though orchids are amazing. Also have the, you know, once you're in the hobby, you start looking at all the different critters. So the assassin bugs, we've got a vinegaroon, a couple different scorpions, which I have the same story as you. I didn't really want the scorpions at first, and then they're really fascinating.
They really are.
Which was weird. Like, out of all the arthropods, I was like, centipedes and scorpions, whatever. And then it's like, wow, even you are... That one-on-one moment when you realize how interesting they are is something that I want to share with others, because it's what makes this hobby so amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not 100% sold on centipedes yet. I've got one.
The chaos is a little hard to wrap your head around.
It is. Yeah. They're a little wild.
Yeah.
So you've been, how long have you been keeping now?
I mean, so I had, as you mentioned in the intro, when I was a kid, I would catch usually full-size mantises from somewhere else that looked like they were pregnant, and then I'd keep them and feed them until they lay their egg sac. Most of the native mantises are temporal, or they need to die every season because they can't live through the winter where I'm from, up in northern Idaho. So you catch them, get their egg sac, they die naturally, and then put that in the garden, and next year that'll hatch, and then there's more mantises around in the area. So I started just by doing that. And catching, I don't know, I remember my dad bringing home like a giant, one of the Atlas moths or whatever that are in the area that have the big giant eye spots that are yay big. Mm-hmm. And I remember that having eggs and having caterpillars and then releasing that in the wild. So there was a lot, like the herping is looking for critters and crawlers. It's usually reptiles and things like that. But that was definitely one of my dad's interactions with me as a kid. So a lot of inverts. Thinking back on it, I've never been bitten or stung when working with an animal, and I'm waiting for that mm-hmm. to change. I have old world tarantulas. I really put all money in on that bet. But I, so far, it's just not pinching them in a way that they're going to be able to grab you as they get pinched, or just respecting how they feel. Even with the scorpions, like if you let them know you're present with like a feather or something, so that they calm down to the touch and realize they're not just being grabbed. So I've played with a lot of insects even as a small child, and I've definitely been stung by something that I didn't know was there. There's been plenty of wasps that have gotten me, but as far as working with animals so far, been good.
Yeah. I've never been bitten or stung either. It's
yeah.
It shocks some people when you say that, you know, like
I'm waiting for your video on
tarantulas for decades and you've never been bit. And it's like, no, if you show them respect and give them their space, then it's really not something in my experience, at least, I'm just talking out of my, from what I know, I guess. Like, I'm not saying this is a fact, but it seems like if you leave them alone and you give them your space, they're not going to bother. You got to go out of your way to upset a tarantula and get bit. It really seems.
Yeah.
From my point of view.
Yeah, I know that maybe there's some species in Australia that will like chase you down, but even some of the chase you down stories, like they talk about it in the desert, and there's the sun spiders or whatever, those weird looking cricket mm-hmm. spider looking things, they chase you to try to get into your shadow because they're a desert species that's trying to find shade. So like these army guys are running for their life because this thing's chasing them when all it's trying to do is find shade in its environment. I don't know, it's just really interesting to see those kind of
that is
nuances.
I've never kept any of the Australian species. A lot of people request that I do videos on them, and I'm like, I don't have any, I haven't seen any, like I got no experience. So kind of like what you were saying, like if I don't have experience on it, it's not information I want to put out there. You know, I'm not going to write a care sheet for something that I've only had for a couple of weeks. Like it drives me crazy. Not so much in the tarantula hobby, or even so, you know, like people that are like doing tarantula videos all the time. I don't see that a lot, but I'll see that somebody that keeps primarily snakes or geckos or something like that gets a pet tarantula and immediately does a care video on it. I'm like, you just said this is your first tarantula. You just got it 2 days ago.
And they usually do a care sheet by like watching Jungle Bob and then just repeating what he said. It's like, no, not another one.
Yeah.
I had that problem with mantises, which is one of the main focuses for my YouTube channel. I just noticed that a lot of people were, here's the mantis I just got, here's the things I found out about it, let's see how it goes. And then they never have another video. And you're just like, oh, I wonder how that mantis went. So I started getting mantises a while ago to start doing videos now, since I've had them at least for a life cycle or two. And I see a lot of stuff that's just parroted. The same thing with the sponge in the water dish for tarantulas. You see a lot of people that say ghosts have a few molts difference, because most mantis species have a difference between how long the males and females last and how many molts they take till maturity. But ghosts don't do that. They actually both have the same number of molts and live for the same amount of times, pretty close. But I just see people say that all the time because they had read that care sheet tip. And it's like, no.
Yeah.
So it definitely separates the experience from non.
You know, a lot of people online get upset when somebody comes into a Facebook group or something like that and asks for care and husbandry advice. You know, they crucify him saying, you know, that you should have done your research. You know, that's what Google's for and stuff like that. But in instances like you're just referring to, sometimes the only thing you find on Google is bad information. Like that nobody's actually done the work and put something out there, at least it's ranking in search where people can find it easily. You know, that's why I'm always a little patient with people asking very beginner questions right off the bat, you know, because it's like they may have done their research and not trusted it, or they may have done their research and come across like a Jungle Bob video or something that's just full of outdated information. You know, so we gotta be patient with new people when it comes to stuff like that.
Definitely. And I mean, there's the difference between answer a question or two that they had and then send them towards reputable sites and they can start. I feel kind of like a fish out of water when people are like, do you have a care sheet for this? Cause I should, as somebody who's getting rid of them, but I don't feel like my care sheets, I would just be copy pasting from somebody else's at this point, either because of I'll tell them how I keep them and what I've found kind of differ from care sheets, and then send them after two or three care sheets. Cause it also spreads out the love in the hobby. You get people that suddenly know about three or four sources that are reputable, which is important to me. Yeah,
that's always good. I mean, with anything really in life, the more sources you have, like the wider that base is, the higher your point of success is going to be, you know, like kind of like a pyramid, you know, the wider you make that base, the higher the point, the pinnacle will be.
Yep.
So that's kind of how I try to approach a lot of stuff that, you know, I'm not familiar with and I'm trying to learn, whether it's tarantulas or reptiles or cameras or editing, you know, whatever it is, I try to like pull from as many sources as I can to really kind of have a solid base. So yeah, I think that's really cool. Now you just graduated from college, right?
Yeah. I went to college. I did a little bit of college in high school for dual enrollment, and then did a little bit of college in Idaho, and they just didn't have quite what I was looking for a degree. And then when I was down in this area, they had all the degrees I wanted, and I just started gobbling them up.
So how did your fascination or obsession, maybe we can say, with like arthropods, affect what you studied in college?
So it's just kind of like anthropology with isopods, the idea that, or in insects, there's an idea that we as humans have been engaging with animals our whole lives for our history. So these smaller groups of people that maybe had a food source that wasn't traditional as today's standards. And so looking into different edible insects was kind of my focus, because it was one of the few things that there's much info on. Wait, hold on a second.
You were studying in college insects that people eat through time?
Less studying and more like bothering my teachers in the background. It was pretty hard to write a paper about it. I did some papers on butterflies and stuff like that, because they're so socially, everybody's stoked on butterflies. And so just the ideas of the ecology behind butterfly releases at weddings and things like that. But my interest and what I was always, I did the food studies course, and it was always what cultures eat what insects, what could we eat in the future to help ourselves with sustainability, not even a directly eating. There's a big cricket protein phase fad right now, and that, and mealworms and things like that. And, eating it in an overpriced hippie bar is cool, and it's great to show that support. But at the same time, looking at using mealworms or crickets to feed protein-hungry animals that we then eat, instead of using soybeans and things that are being overproduced, use something that can maybe the crickets or the cockroaches eat waste, and then you feed that to the chickens in a way that makes a more sustainable cradle-to-cradle approach. So
yeah,
I started raising mealworms again because I was working with quail, and quail need a higher protein feed than most chicken foods on the market provide. So I was just raising mealworms to supplement my quail. And it made me realize that a lot of backyard chicken keepers should be keeping bugs. So there's a whole group of people that they would really benefit from being able to throw their kitchen waste into a cockroach bin that they then feed their chickens the cockroaches, and they get better eggs. So yeah, those kind of cycles within food studies and within ethics were really interesting to me.
Yeah, it definitely sounds interesting. I do like my algorithm online, my feed or whatever, is kind of skewed at the moment, because I was searching for places to buy mealworms and crickets online, just have them shipped directly to me. And now it's like constantly suggesting these protein bars made from crickets.
Yeah.
I'm like, I really don't want to eat that.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a company in town that's when I started talking to the teachers about it. They're like, there's a cricket protein company. And I was like, no, I'm looking more for like what other insects could be. Everybody's just stoked on mealworms and crickets, but there's a lot of different species of insects.
Yeah, and I've always find it fascinating. Cultures around the world eat things like scorpions and tarantulas, stuff that like I never would consider eating them. But, you know, with the way things are right now, sometimes, you know, with just politics and viruses and stuff like that, sometimes my mind goes to survival mode. And I'm like, if worst case scenario happened, like I've got gas masks, and I've got a basement full of tarantulas. So, you know, if I have to eat them, I've got like a farm down here.
Yeah, and their venom's going to be located in a way that they're not going to have. I mean, as long as you can like singe off those urticating hairs, you should be good. But yeah, and the other, just the idea that, I don't know, I've always been kind of rude. I grew up in Northern Idaho. We're all backwoodsy people. And I've always just kind of said, you know, if you starved in the woods, you might have just not been looking at your options, because there's all sorts of critters you could have been nibbling on. I mean, obviously keep an eye on poisons, but at the same time, like, you could have eaten some earthworms for a few days.
But, yeah, there's grubs everywhere out there. Yeah. not Idaho, probably not as remote as you guys are, but I'm in West Virginia, and it's pretty sparsely populated here. You spend a lot of times as a kid, you know, a lot of your time spent out in the woods, and you know, with Boy Scouts and stuff like that, that survival training was always my favorite, you know, just finding what you could eat as far as plants and grubs and things like that. I remember we did a winter survival once when I was in high school, and that was the most brutal because everything was, you know, frozen and there was snow everywhere. But I don't know why, like I would be okay with eating earthworms or grubs or something like that, but I don't know if I could force myself to eat a tarantula. Like, yeah. I think maybe I just have like an emotional attachment to them now. It's like,
and it's funny because, yeah. And a lot of the cultures that I've looked into, they kind of feel the same way about each other, even though they're both eating arthropods of some sort. They're like, ew, they eat scorpions. And the other like, ew, they eat grubs. And it's like, oh, what a weird thing to nitpick. But yeah, I guess if you love your scorpions, you're going to have to figure out which grubs are on the menu. And that's like Australia. There's a big grub hunting culture there. And I know that there's a culture for like agave worms from an agave moth that's in Mexico. And so, yeah, it's surprisingly common for how little is known about it. And so, yeah, it's an interesting thing to bring to light, because then you start having that like idea again of, well, if this animal was useful to humans, and what's the cultural significance behind that, and is it worth, you know, looking into protecting agave areas that have these moths in order to keep that cultural interest? So
yeah, and that, I think that's a cool way to kind of get people into conservation, you know, is looking at the cultural aspect of it. And because I think sometimes people, you know, when they think about conservation, and we talked about this briefly before we started recording, but, you know, it's, when I think of conservation, I'm thinking penguins, polar bears, you know, like elephants and rhinos and stuff like that. But what we're learning, I guess, a lot like right now is that things like bumblebees are exceedingly more important to the ecosystem, you know, and other arthropods, insects, stuff like that. Like what you were discussing, kind of tying that in to get people interested in the conservation aspect of these, you know, you kind of initiate that sort of interest in them, and then people seem a little more willing to care, I guess.
And so bumblebees are an easy one because they're adorable. But that's the other thing, is like the idea that, like bees are important, but people usually think honeybees because yay honey, but there's actually a whole group of native bees, hundreds of species, that are in tune to the native flowers in a way that they emerge at a time that honeybees would still be huddled in there. There's a whole different pollination schedule that you capture when you use your mind to think of the large, vast bee populations that are not on the radar because they're not the honeybee. But we need the ambassador anyway, like the yay honeybees, but use that to kind of navigate into yay all bees. which is,
yeah. So it sounds like, just from our conversation, that conservation is a pretty big thing as far as you're concerned. Like, how are you involved in conservation?
And that's, it's not so much conservation as much as the idea that conservation can also engage positively for humans. So that's my interest in conservation, is on the ground movements that are benefiting everyone, not just cutting people out of an area. There's a lot of really questionable things we've done in the name of conservation that don't realize that people are part of the landscape. And that's whether it's natives or traditional knowledge that's being lost because people have been on that landscape, and there's a common Western idea that that's not something that is natural. So using animals with conservation in a way that it benefits everyone. I mentioned to you the bee example in Africa. There's issues with the elephants raiding crops. And so as a culture, they're having issues with elephants that we don't understand. And therefore some elephants are being taken out because they're problem animals. And so one of the biologists realized that elephants are terrified of bees. And she even put a recording of bees where they usually kind of hang out, and turned it on once the elephants had relaxed, and they just took off without even questioning what it was. They're just like, no, bees, I'm out. And so the idea of, they made these fences that there's like a beehive and then another beehive, and they're all connected by wires that if you move them, the bees get upset because their hives jiggled. So they're not even really that difficult to design the fences. They're not like taut elephant-proof fences because elephants are getting through everything. They're really intelligent. And so now not only do you have elephants that don't even want anything to do with that fence line, but you get honey, which, so the local population gets to show, gets to grow through their agriculture with the elephants still present on the land. And they have a new honey that's elephant safe honey. So any kind of tourism in that area is stoked on the ecological situation. So yeah, just that kind of weird nitpicking, like kind of roundabout conservation is really what interests me more than, I mean, of course we need to save habitat and all that kind of stuff. But I think if we don't value saving it as people, and we don't value what's in that habitat and what we can learn or get from that, it's not going to have enough momentum with the current capitalist structures. So if we value something, boy, we're good about it.
Yeah. I mean, that happens all around the world. Like it's, that trying to find that balance between what people need in a capitalist society, balanced against the ecology of the area, can be very difficult. Like what we see happening in Brazil. They're intentionally burning down rainforests and stuff like that for farmland and urban sprawl and decimating native species there, while at the same time not wanting anybody to export those species. And, it causes a lot of issues. And it's like, I don't know. It's almost like there's this cognitive dissonance. Like, we don't want to do anything to save these species, but we're also going to destroy them, or at least their habitat. And it's kind of frustrating, at least like from where I am, to see these like beautiful tarantula species that I'm really into, and knowing that they're, their habitat's being destroyed, but also at the same time understanding that people need land to farm, and I can understand, I guess, I try to put myself in other people's shoes in that situation. Like if I needed to expand my farm so I can make enough money for my family to survive, would I care about tarantulas that are living in the trees or the forest, just beyond my property line?
Exactly.
So it's a difficult line to walk.
Yeah. And I think I mentioned it to you, the idea of, the pet trade's always blamed for taking these animals out with poachers and things like that. But the idea of actually networking in a way that maybe you're extracting those animals through local resources and giving back to that community in a way that they start valuing those animals. And it's not just one or two poachers that go to all different areas that they know these tarantulas are at, but the tarantula hobby is reaching out and saying, hey, this area has this amazing animal. We would like to support this area because of that. And it's the same thing with, you just all of a sudden that species is given value and that area is given value. But with Brazil currently, there's a lot of political things where they just don't want to be valued in that way. There's a lot of, racial divide. So it's not the people that are in the area that's being deforested that have been doing the deforesting, but like I said, Hank Green does a much better video on that. The Brazil is being burned video is eye opening for sure.
Yeah. There's, I was talking, I guess it was, Gar from Arachnotube. He was on the podcast earlier and we were kind of touching on a similar topic and, you know, it giving value to the people in a location, like, some kind of monetary value to, you know, the species that are endemic or native to their area, it can be very beneficial. The method worked for coffee, at least, you know, like it was like these huge companies, you know, just farming these massive acres of coffee beans, and they were paying the workers like slave wages almost, you know, for picking them and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, you started getting these coffee, roasters. That's what they're called. Looking for, like, doing just pretty much the fair trade coffee, finding small farms and investing in that population, you know, in that small little village or something to get higher quality coffee, and paying them a lot better wage, at least, than what they would get just as a picker on some huge agricultural kind of, massive farm. And it's both given us a better coffee product and has also, you know, really helped kind of lift up that small village or those small farmers to make a lot more money than they would. So it would be nice to kind of take that model and apply it to snakes and scorpions and tarantulas and you know, other inverts and arthropods. I think it would, because people, I don't think if you're not in the hobby, you don't see any value to them at all. You know?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
What's all around you, almost everywhere you look, and makes your life better? Birds. Learn all about these beautiful creatures in this wonderful new podcast called Birds of a Feather Talk Together. Two experts guide two newbies on their journey to learn more. Mallard ducks, ivory-billed woodpeckers, Hawaiian honeycreepers, blue jays, cardinals, sandhill cranes, and more. Each week we discuss a different bird and walk away with a better understanding of the birds all around us. Oh, and we have a ton of fun doing it. Listen now. You're going to like learning about these birds. I guarantee it.
Yeah, and that's, like you said, the hobby's growing. So I think that would be this smart way to grow the hobby, because you're also going to, you know, they use that bias of, oh, the pet trade just takes everything out. That they use that to make things like the Lacey Act and things like that. And so I feel like if we move towards sustainable conservation through, and the other side of it is a lot of times I feel like a conservation says save the Amazon, save the Arctic, and they don't really talk about how important your ecosystem where you are is and how amazing just outside is and what amazing critters, what beetles you have that might be just like outstandingly neat. Because if you focus there, you have a lot more voting influence. Same thing as following these tarantulas, getting the people in the area where the tarantulas are at to be valued saves that land better than sending $5 to who knows where. And so when people are interested in what's in their backyard and that becomes worldwide because of, you know, the pet trade, I think that would really show a lot of conservational influx that we're not seeing.
Yeah. I know a guy lives around here. He's a professor at one of the local universities, and he's in, I don't think he's a herpetologist, but he really likes snakes. I think he's more into crayfish or something like that is what he actually teaches. But he, you know, he's in the biology kind of department at the university. And we were on Facebook or something like that. And he had posted some pictures of his backyard, and he had just essentially just took in a bunch of like tires and, like cut down trees and stuff like that, and created an environment for like the native species of snakes to kind of thrive, like in his own backyard. And he's like, it's awesome because one, I've got a lot of snakes living back here now that I find extremely fascinating. And now I don't have to mow my lawn. I just kind of let it overgrow and do its thing in a safe, responsible way, so his neighbors aren't complaining. But it does give, you know, it gives a home to a lot of snakes, but also, you know, other native species of insects and mammals and all kinds of stuff. It was a pretty cool idea. I was tempted to do that myself.
Yeah, I kind of had the same thing when I mentioned my mom raises mealworms for bluebirds, and we showed up at the ranch and there were just you couldn't go outside without mosquitoes. And so you're spraying yourself with who knows what nasty mosquito sprays, and they didn't even really care. They were pretty tenacious. I don't know if you have mosquitoes in that area as well. But mom started feeding bluebirds on these little flat lids with mealworms in it. And we had maybe two pair originally. And now when I visit, there's probably 40 or 50 birds that like hang out on the fence line at a certain time of the day waiting for their mealworms. And there's a ton of swallows. My dad allowed swallows to kind of build their nests under the barn and this and that. So it ended up being just putting some mealworms out to sustain the local wildlife. Now there's no mosquitoes. If you go all the way down into the bottom of the canyon, you can find some mosquitoes where the birds aren't at. But I was away for college for most of the like ecosystem change. And I came home, I was like, there are no mosquitoes. Where really? Like, and that's just, it's just such a long, slow journey. But all of a sudden you wake up one day and you're like, just that little bit of animal support created an ecosystem that I'm now more comfortable in, which is less pesticide use because I don't have to get rid of the mosquitoes.
Yeah. So you, what exactly are you doing? You've got Arthropod Ambassadors where you're selling stuff online, but you're also doing like a mobile zoo, or explain that.
I'm not going to do it justice. Oh no, you're fine. It's pretty much trying to do what you do with your channel. And so I have so many critters that are amazing. And I did a table one time at an event for a farm that I was working at and had just some mantises and some isopods and different species of cockroaches set up. And I had a line at that table all day from the like CSA people that wanted to see, what do you mean there's a roly poly that's striped, and just things I didn't, you know, once you're in the hobby enough, you don't realize how so many other people are amazed by these things that you just have been feeding a while. So I decided I need to take them on in a way that I can get them to other people and to see. And the videos are amazing, especially when you do macros like you do, like, you can really be there with the tarantula. But being able for people to just like look at this animal and see how it's interacting or reacting to them is the kind of thing you remember as a kid when like the people with the birds or natural animals come into the classroom or something. It just hits us differently. And I think that that's really an important part of the being able to engage people. So I'm hoping to just bring, either do specimens. So you can see I have some pinned specimens. This is an amblypygii molt and things like that, so that people can really have a one-on-one, and then have some of the tarantulas. The tarantulas are going to be tricky because I want to show how they web. I feel like that's a really important aspect of tarantulas, is they're home designers. Like, they'll pull stuff up, and this amazing designer thing that I didn't realize about them either. And I want to show that off. So trying to figure out a way to do maybe exoterras. You can see one of my GBBs right there. That slide in, or some other kind of enclosures that can be taken out so that animal can always be in that enclosure and design it for itself. Whereas the enclosures for the mantises, they don't really modify their habitat. So I could just have enclosures that I can put mantises into and take them back out of and not have to worry. Their display doesn't have to do as much as with their house working. So trying to figure out all that kind of stuff. And then it's going to be pretty much a hand cart, about bicycle cart size, that I can put underneath a pop-up if it's at an actual event, or I can just take it on the sidewalks at bigger things. It's pretty nice weather down here, so I don't have to worry too much about cooling it. I'm probably just going to have some heat strips for certain species, but yeah, working on it. Got the welder. We're learning how to weld so we can make the frame, and it's a whole project.
You're going all out.
Yeah. I mean, they represent themselves amazingly, but whatever I can do to really support that.
So how did you get into like actually selling these, different, like you sell isopods and mantises and.
Yeah. The ghosts are my main thing I have too much of. It's mostly just, I want more people to see more bugs. And the easiest way to do that is for people to have bugs. And the mantises are great because you've got about a year commitment at most, which is a bummer about mantises. But at the same time, especially for children, it gets you into that cycle of life and death. Like, things do pass away, they get old. I've had pets all my life, so I can handle it really well, but maybe learning that with a mantis is the first time that kid's going to experience that kind of feeling. And so engaging people that way, just with like life lessons, and then having something that, when with pet stores, it's always been such an ethical thing, like you get a six-year-old a parakeet, like, whoa, that was a big commitment. Yeah. I could never work at a pet store. But so the idea of
turtles are the ones that blow my mind.
Yeah. Not, you know, saddling somebody with that commitment accidentally. And so that's
like, I was in Florida, and for whatever reason, I got this idea in my mind that I wanted some kind of turtle. And I went to the pet store and they had they were like about the size of a silver dollar, little red eared sliders. And I was like, oh, this is perfect. And, you know, of course, I'm like, 18, 19 years old, something like that. A young guy, not really, just very impulsive, and didn't do any research at all, and got it all set up. And then, like, after I had everything set up, what I thought it would want, I finally did a little bit of research and realized this thing lives for like 30 or 40 years or longer, and it gets huge, and like it's going to grow to the size of the tank. And within a few years, it seemed that we went from like a 10-gallon tank to a 40-gallon tank.
Yeah.
And it was still growing. I was like, this is getting out of hand.
Yeah.
Nobody told me anything. Like,
want to sell it.
It was my responsibility. but the people at the pet shop didn't say, hey, this looks cute, but it's going to smell really bad and be a lot of work, and it's going to get big. Like, nobody gave me a warning or a heads up about that.
Yeah. And that's the other thing is a lot of keepers have made mistakes of that sort, and just being open to talking with people about it. Cause I think a lot of those experiences, people hide them because they feel like they're going to get negative attention for bringing it up, and any even negative issues with why did you do that to your tarantula, or how could you do that to your mantis? And it's like, maybe we shouldn't come at it that way, because we all make mistakes, and being able to learn from others' mistakes means less mistakes made. And it's also just gives almost a brotherhood. My parents got me an iguana when I was a kid. I had this cute little sand species of lizard. I'm guessing it got impaction because there wasn't as much hobby info on not keeping them on sand. And we had a sand tank because it's a desert species, leopard gecko stuff. It wasn't a leopard gecko, but that same kind of, now the hobby is super informative about things like that. But yeah, they got me another lizard, and they got me an iguana, which grew like 5 feet, and I loved him, and I tried hanging out with him as much as I could. We'd put his cage inside and out to get good UV in the summertime. And my dad was bringing him in one time and just grabbed him without like waking him up, and he bit him really bad. And so then he kind of wouldn't let me work with him because he felt like it was a dangerous animal, which just, bad cycle. But it's that's something that I've had an experience with, that if somebody was interested in iguana, I would definitely want to say my experience. But if you're working at a pet store and just want to move one of the 7 tiny baby iguanas stuck in that corner over there, like, you're not going to get that engagement. And people are afraid to ask about it because there's, people can be kind of aggressive in the hobby. But at this time, I've got nothing I have needs UVB or UVA. I've got the leopard geckos and the hognose, and I've kind of focused on not getting something that needs a basking area and this and that, because I feel like my husbandry, I could do it, but I don't want to saddle future Aaron with having to still do it 10 years from now. So, and the leopard gecko, I'm definitely on, I think some of them can have substrate. And I think the very expensive morphs also have some neurological problems that they would eat substrate and not even think about it. And people have experienced that and said no to everything. So it is safest to do no. But like my normal leopard gecko that I hang out with, that's my buddy, Princess Snow, very focused, able to eat, grabs her food. My really fancy tangerine leopard gecko male will grab a hold of I have him on some of the like shelf liner, and he'll go to get a mealworm and he'll grab that shelf liner and he will try his hardest to eat that shelf liner. Like, he'll rip at it and just like, this is definitely the worm I just tried to eat. And so between those two animals, I don't have Princess on substrate, but I would trust her on it. But him, I would never put on substrate. So it's definitely gecko to gecko, and so it's safest just to be like, don't even think about it. But yeah, it definitely keeps a contrasting experience in the hobby that has kept that as a hot topic.
Yeah. Russ and I from Aquarimax talked about that in the last podcast, I think. Cause I right now I have both of my leopard geckos in bioactive enclosures on substrate, and, but they're not fancy at all. Like, pet shop.
They don't need to be. They're amazing
geckos, and they're doing well. But I have my son. Every time we go to the pet store, which is very frequently, they have those bearded dragons, and they're maybe like 6-9 inches long. And he begs me for them, and I'm like, buddy, you don't understand.
Yeah,
like, you're gonna go to college soon, in like 5-6 years, and then I have to take care of this huge 5-foot long
40-gallon extra tank.
I was like, we're not doing that.
No. And that's, it's kind of nice to have friends that have critters too, so that you can kind of get, I have a friend who has a milk snake, and every once in a while I'm like, can I play with the milk snake for a little bit? Like, I have hognose and I understand yeah. it's similar, but like, I just want to hang out with something else, but I don't want to buy it because.
I have a milk snake, but I never see it.
Yeah. They're pure chaos to handle. Like, you just can't stop. They just, yeah. Or the one I was working with is just, yeah. Compared to the hognose, they just like hang on and are there for the ride.
Yeah. Like my ball python, will, it's very chill and relaxed and will just kind of wrap around and cuddle up. But man, that milk snake, first thing it does is musk all over me and then just try to fly out of my hands. And it's like, yeah, okay, I'll just let you be. It just stays in hiding most of the time. Comes out to eat or shit. That's about it. And I've got a couple of king snakes, and they're, we got the eastern king snake is very friendly. I enjoy handling her a lot. The California king snake I have, it just wants to eat. And it doesn't understand that sometimes I'm just trying to change its water, not give it a mouse. It just starts striking. It's like, all right, I'll give you your space, buddy.
Well, and it's so great that you can actually judge animals that way. You can understand that there's their food response involved. And yeah, it's, a lot of people would just say, I have the meanest snake. And it's like, well, yeah. But he's not.
Yeah, I don't think he's mean. He's just, he just likes to eat. He's a little pig. But you got, all kinds of, like you sent me some ghost mantises. And there was one that we, like, I can't remember. You probably know. It's some kind of very, it's a beautiful mantis, but it's apparently very difficult to keep.
So I think somebody else, you got an orchid at the same time and you got a dead leaf at the same time I sent you the ghosts. And yeah. Those two are from somebody else, but I don't know who. But you gave me the credit for the orchid that one time. I was just like, oh, I think I text. I think I, you were in live chat and I was in the live chat like, oh, no. Don't give me that credit.
Oh, man.
They're beautiful. Yeah. And like you said, they can be finicky. The ghosts are definitely bomb proof in comparison to most mantises. And the cats, which are behind me here, there's some cat mantises that they're like, for their shape, they're super elongated. So you'd think they'd have molting problems, and they're doing really good. I haven't actually had any issues with it. But yeah,
this is I've never had this species, but I've seen a lot of pictures of it online. It's some kind of, I don't want to say it's a devil orchid or mantis or something like that. But I was looking at it and people were saying it needs like a basking spot.
The
of like
devil, the devil's flower, the Idabolica. Yeah. Devil's flowers are one of those, like, everybody in the hobby sees it and wants it. And I came across a deal where they weren't as expensive. He was doing communal deals so that he could get feedback on how they acted as a communal, because they'd been on the hobby list for like about $40 to $60 each for a baby. And when you get an animal that expensive and it passes away, that's a bummer. And that's definitely a devil's flowers. I ended up setting up a pretty successful system, which was a really cheap indoor greenhouse, like those three-tier, three-shelf, 2-foot-wide, 3-foot-wide greenhouses. They fit the mantis enclosure perfectly. And then I put an incandescent, I think 40-watt, 50-watt bulb above them, because they need to bask at 115 degrees, which is outrageously hot, but they want about 40 to 100% humidity. So I just had to put them in a greenhouse and throw an incandescent in it. And then I did a cocoa fiber bottom. And after I finally set all that up, I did a couple different setups and I lost a mantis here and a mantis there. Some of them just never did molt. Some of them had miss molts. I have a lot of them in resin because they were still pretty expensive. So trying to save the losses I've had in a different way. But they're definitely, if you have them set up right, they were great once that happened. All the rest of mine got to adult. But yeah, if you're not ready for that, it's a big, expensive mistake. So
that's what the ghosts are amazing. It's a lot of work.
Yeah. I mean, once the setup, it was, you know, an extra $100 in equipment, just getting the light, the heat mat in that greenhouse. So if you're already spending $40 on a bug, it's not too bad, but they definitely are one of those, like, everybody wants it. Everybody has a bad experience. Everybody's super like, bah, why did
it? It reminds me of those, sun spiders. Like, everybody wants a sun spider. People ask me all the time if I have any, and it's like, they don't do well in captivity.
That's all I've ever heard about them.
Yeah, I haven't really heard anybody that's kept them successfully. And I was at a reptile expo, and they were selling them. They had like, I mean, they had maybe 10 or 12 specimens there. And I was like, well, it's here. And the guy's giving me a really good deal on it. So I'll grab one. And the poor thing didn't survive the trip home. It's like, by the time I got home and unboxed it and, you know, and put it in its enclosure, it was already very lethargic. I did everything I could. And the poor guy just did not survive like more than a week or a few days after getting, like, I think he was already on his way out when I picked him up off the table. And since yeah, then it's like, I really don't even want to get involved with that.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I want to avoid with the insect hobby. So most of the species, I work with some species like the devils, I would not have sold them. And currently I have a few orchids that I have available and I'm making people go to a form, Google Forms, and fill out all of these things to make sure they've done their research. So, cause I also don't want to give them to people that have the money. Yeah, a little. I mean, they don't have to pass it. They just have to go through it. And then if they get things wrong, I'm like, hey, just to let you know, the males are super small and only live for 4 months and they need a smaller enclosure for their, when you have a, I don't know, everybody that gets an animal is like, whoa, big, huge enclosure is going to be awesome. But really with mantises, they need to be able to find their food. And so as long as the enclosure kind of needs to be smaller and simpler for the teeny tiny babies. Once you get a larger animal that can like engage with a 10 gallon, sure, but don't put a nymph in a 5 gallon enclosure or an Exoterra Nano. So yeah, just trying to kind of like.
The orchid mantis, what's the lifespan on a female orchid?
I've heard almost up to 2 years from one Mantidology is one of my main mantis go-to guys. And he said that he had a female live for quite some time, but they're also super prone to bacterial infections. And with needing the high humidity as well, it's just a. Yeah, it's kind of a double whammy. You've got a species that has bacteria issues and needs high humidity, which causes bacterial issues. And that's the main, like, I found out about it the hard way with bad feeders, but it's called the Black Death. And it's about as bad as it sounds. Mantis keepers, it's a bacterial infection that mantis keepers, you see the mantis throw up black goo and you're pretty much, it's too late. So... that's one that you can get from just having crickets. That's the controversy about crickets is mostly because a lot of crickets are kept in conditions where they have bacterial issues that they themselves are living through. They can handle it. But if that bacterial issue passes to an animal that can't handle it, then you get that. And there's also something about, I have an experience for myself, but I've heard a lot online, carrots are supposed to have some sort of an antifungal chemical that can hurt mantises. And I'm not sure if it's true or not, but a lot of mantis feeders forbid carrots for the feeders of the mantis. And that's one of the things when you're keeping mantises, you're not keeping mantises, you're keeping mantis food and you get the perk of having a mantis. So a lot of, yeah, you get those little babies, you're going to need to learn about fruit fly cultures. And when they get a little bit bigger, a lot of species prefer flying insects. They don't need them. You can kind of hand feed a lot of them. But it's a lot easier to throw flies in than try to like get one of the cats to eat a superworm because you have to kind of touch it to their mouth and then they'll kind of start engaging with it. But a lot of times they're so intimidated by you that it takes a second to get a feeding response. So yeah, the feeders are
I don't have
most
any,
of the mantis training.
I don't have any flies. What I've been feeding my mantises are, and now I'll have to look at that, but I've been feeding them crickets and mealworms. And they take it right off the tongs every time. I haven't had any. And occasionally I can drop one in there and it'll see it climbing up the stick or something and pounce on it.
Yep. And I definitely suggest to people, like if you're having an issue with feeding your mantis, just put it in, you can have a beautiful cage and take it out for feeding time and put it in an enclosure where it can spot that food. So if you don't have flying animals, you can still engage them with ground prey as long as that ground prey is not going to take off and hide in the substrate. So it takes a second of husbandry to move them in and out, but it's worth it for a well-fed animal. Also, I feel like a lot of tarantula keepers feed their mantises a lot less than they need. I've seen on a few different shows, it seems like the how often you feed tarantulas is about a quarter as much as the metabolism that mantises need. So I see that as a husbandry mistake pretty commonly.
How often should you be feeding a mantis?
I look more at abdomen size than how often. I mean, I definitely make sure mine are pretty plump. I never let one of my mantises stay skinny unless she's after a molt for a couple of days and let them harden up. But yeah, it's more of a make sure they look like little Christmas tree bulbs and not little pieces of paper kind of a thing. And so it's a body shape more than, I'm probably honestly probably feed my tarantulas wrong, because I definitely feed them and then their body's fat and I'm like, oh, okay, I'm just not going to feed you anymore. You're huge. So I do the opposite.
My, I have a dead leaf mantis. She's huge. And I just fed her a hornworm. I had some small green hornworms, and I was feeding tarantulas for the Fatal Fangs kind of competition they got. Nice. I was trying to get some good footage, and nobody was really doing anything exciting on camera. And I was like, well, I need to feed my mantis. So I pulled it down and just kind of dangled it in front of her, see if she like leaped and grabbed that thing and took it all down. And I was like, wow, I didn't think you would eat something that big.
Yeah. But, and that's another thing I've heard a few people, and I've read in the mantis keeping book by Oren, that mantises won't overeat. This guy is a must have. You have to get the, Keeping the Praying Mantis by Oren McMongel. But also some of the things in here I feel are a little bit opinion based through his experience, which is an important thing to build on. But I've definitely had experiences where I've put too many fruit flies into a certain species enclosure and they've eaten themselves to bursting. And I've come back and been like, what happened? And it was definitely just a miscalculation. Most mantises won't do it, and most of the species I sell won't do it, but I have had it happen. And then when I was reading that book, he was just like, oh, that doesn't happen. And I was like, well, oh.
You've got empirical evidence that it proves it does.
Yeah, which is, I mean, yeah, maybe it was super full and fell from the top. There wasn't any sign of that, but maybe it fell and had an impact when it was full. There's definitely ways around it. But yeah, from my experience, some species will overeat. Maybe if they've hadn't eaten in long enough that they were kind of desperate or something of that sort. Like one day without food means more desperation and overeating compared to something that's slowly fed. Which again is a reason to continually feed your mantises and not do just like once a week. So,
As soon as we're done with this podcast, I'm going to feed my mantises.
But not too much. Few days.
So what's a good beginner species of mantis if somebody was wanting to get their first one?
So, I mean, it really depends on how interested you are. If you want to see what it's like to keep a mantis, I would suggest going outside and getting interested in your local ecology and finding a mantis that you can then, if you're having issues feeding it or keeping feeders or anything like that, you can release back out into its natural environment. It also just engages people with the outdoors in a way that I think is really important. So there's native mantis species. I have found that raising baby mantises of certain species, the ones you can find like at garden stores, when they hang from an enclosure, like a natural, like you're in a butterfly cage, so you all hang from the top, they'll actually start to kind of fold their abdomens down in a way that really affects their ability to molt or eat. So there are certain species of natural mantises that are harder to keep than you find a lot of the tropical exotic species. But if you're committed to keeping an animal its entire life cycle, I would definitely say ghost mantises, Philocrania paradoxa, are amazing. They just in singular, they're a little smaller, but in singular, they just are fantastically built, just ornate species. They don't need any temperature regulation of any type. They can handle warm or cold. They change their color depending on their environment. So you can actually get green females that'll turn like grassy after if they're kept a little less dry. So you can actually kind of realize your husbandry skills because it'll be reflected in the color for your mantis. So it'll be like, oh, I must keep my mantises dry because they're all grass colored, but they still can survive it just fine. But yeah, ghosts are for sure. Like I was saying, the cat eye mantises I've been not having very much trouble with. So I would suggest that species at this point because I've kept them long enough to not really have issues. Spiny flower mantises are pretty amazing like half the time. I hear people keep them exactly the same way, myself included, and they'll be thriving, they'll be doing great, and then all of a sudden you'll get some sort of a black death issue, which is a feeder problem, or they're a little sensitive randomly, and it seems like maybe I think they need to be kept warmer and drier, but with a misting schedule, but not consistently humid. They seem a little nitpicky, but other than that, they're pretty hardy. And then if you go to the end of the scale, you get orchids are pretty easy to care for, but definitely not a beginner species. And then we were talking about devil's flowers. Just, yeah, try everything else first.
Yeah. Work your way up.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the ladder.
Yeah. But I the ghost mantis I have, like, they're all in the ones you send me, they're all in the exact same style of enclosure. And like I said, I'm a pretty, I assume that it's the exact same setup. And, you know, feed them and mist them and everything around the same time. And half of them are kind of like a brownish color and the other half are a bright green color. And I'm like, what is the difference? Like, how is
this? So there'll be genetics as well. Is it a dark brown?
Yeah. Like one of them's kind of a dark brown.
Yeah. So only females can turn green. So if they have green genetics, but they're male, and then also some don't have the green genetics. So they'll just stay a darker brown and then turn a lighter brown if they're in humidity. Because everybody wants a green ghost. And I'm always just like, okay, there's like a percentage chance they could be a green ghost. And then also you have to take care of them to make them a green ghost. So it's like a double double test. But yeah, they have a genetic component as well as the green change.
Interesting. And you also have a lot of isopods, right? About how many species do you keep?
Ooh, 2, 4 is about 12, I think. I have just a shoebox of each species. When I do a bioactive tank, I really like to just find out which species will thrive by just putting a couple different species in. And if one of them outcompetes, that's the one that should be in that tank. So you have like powder oranges and things that can kind of handle a drier enclosure, including the Hoffman's eggy and bigger, drier isopods. And then I have success with some of the armadillidium. Boy, that's a hard one every time. Porcelio will be in a wetter enclosure and do pretty well. And then there's always the dwarf purples that are under there doing the real work. But I'm definitely, Aquarimax is the isopod guy. I'm definitely doing the, like, as long as I don't put two species that can interbreed together, I'll sometimes put armadillidium with the Porcelio and just see which species in that setup overtakes the other. And then just as soon as I start, usually you'll see the difference in one of the groups won't have smaller babies. So most likely the other species is taking advantage of babies during molt. So then I definitely separate and have original cultures that are just one species, but I do like to kind of experiment just for the sake of the bioactive cultures that I'm setting up and to help suggest it to people.
You sent me some isopods as well, didn't you?
Yeah, I sent you some of the Hoffs. They were the giant gray Spanish, because I know you with your macro lens, I was like, and they're one of those species that's kind of cost prohibitive, but really amazing. So I was like, yeah, you have the equipment to film this isopod. So that's the reason I sent you both. Yeah. I've said it 1,000 times. I'll probably say it a couple times on this podcast, but I just want more people to meet more bugs. And I saw your filming technique, and I saw that you don't just like film something and tell people that you know about it. You wait to have it. So I was like, well, if I send him a ghost now, by next year, we'll get our ghost care video. And I just, I've been in the pet hobby my whole life. I've been going to the pet stores with the babysitters just to, you know, be there and see what's in without needing to buy anything. And I've never heard of these species. It seems like it just out of nowhere. I was like, wait, you can keep what? Wow. And I'd seen like illegal stick insects and things like that, you know, the small enough pet store that hadn't gotten caught yet. And so I'd seen that kind of stuff, but never the mantises. And now that the isopod hobby's exploding, it's the same thing. You go up to people and you're like, you think you know what a roly-poly looks like? And then you open up this thing where there's clowns and zebras and dairy cows and bright orange and rubber duckies. It's just mind blown. And you get that moment where you realize what you think you know about something could be improved, and we can go for it. Speaking of which, I know you tell everybody you want them back on, but if you can push for Patricia coming back on, I really liked that therapy session. I was getting free therapy too. I was just like, oh yeah, yeah. That was a fantastic podcast. Yeah. It was amazing.
Yeah, I enjoyed talking to her. You know, the isopods you sent me, those are probably of all of them, the species I have right now, those are probably my favorite. Like, I really enjoy watching them, and they're breeding like crazy right now. Like, there's probably two or three times the amount that you actually sent last time I checked. And then I wasn't sure if they were, like, initially they weren't breeding, and I was kind of worried. And I reached out to Russ over at Aquarimax and was like, hey, what am I doing wrong? And he kind of, you know, gave me some tips, and I followed his advice. And now there's, you know, 5 or 6 different sizes of them in there. And I'm actually going to be moving them into a larger enclosure. I'm just waiting for the enclosure to come in the mail. Tarantula Cribs is sending me a big enclosure for them, so I'm kind of excited to do that. So they're doing really well. So I just wanted to say thank you for sending those.
Thank you for showing them off. They're beautiful, and they just really, again, just put another dimension to Roly-Poly or potato bug. And yeah, they, if I remember right, their husbandry is just a little drier than what you'd expect from an isopod. That's how I keep mine, at least. And they definitely, I'll see them just hovering out away from anything moist. They're just like on their own cruising. And I'm like, what are you doing? You're supposed to be hiding under a log.
Yeah, they definitely are out. He told me I needed more ventilation. Even though I was kind of keeping them dry, there wasn't enough kind of air circulating to keep the air dry. So, you know, I like tripled the amount of holes that I had drilled in there. And then, you know, it just, the population's just exploding now. So it's funny and interesting how just small changes in habitat, you know, in the climate in an enclosure. Wow, that's difficult to say. Can really have a drastic change on, you know, what species you have in there. It's not something that I think I noticed as much with like tarantulas and snakes and stuff like that. You know, it's, you just do what you're supposed to do. And small changes don't really seem to affect them that much. But isopods, maybe because they're smaller, they're a lot more sensitive to small changes and can make it break it.
Well, and you're also dealing with, you're judging whether they're doing well by how many more you're having. And like with a tarantula, if you were setting up for a breeding of a tarantula versus just keeping one in captivity, there's probably going to be a lot more nitpicking. I haven't dealt with breeding tarantulas yet, but yeah, definitely if you want them to just be there and themselves, they can survive a few things, but to set them up for success with breeding, you're going to need to be a little more nitpicky, which.
Yeah. That's something Dustin was talking about when he was on the podcast, like raising the humidity or the temperature or lowering the temperature, the time of year. Like there's all kinds of
brood mating, things like that. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, and even just the care, like I just put the heater in the insect room and all of a sudden I'm doubling my spraying and having to double check everything because the humidity in the entire room is on its head. Which is another reason I hesitate to try to write care sheets, because most of the time I say, well, what does the mantis need? Like, is it bowing down to drink because it needs more to drink? Or does it seem annoyed that you're spraying it all the time? Like, I don't know what your humidity is. I don't know what your ambient room temperature is. They're probably fine at room temperature unless you live at 50 degrees. Like, I didn't know that. And so, it's hard to write a care sheet for somebody when the exact same care sheet's probably not going to work when they turn their heat on in the winter. And just being aware of that environment is part of it.
Yeah. Like on my website and in my videos, or at least, you know, in most of them, I point that fact out. Like, I think I even had a whole video about how care sheets can be dangerous because, you know, what I'm doing is telling you how I keep them and I'm doing successful. And these, you know, I live in this part of the world and, you know, I'm like in a valley. So I got mountains on one side, but I'm also like, there's a creek like within 1,000 feet from me, you know, and that feeds into a river that's less than a mile away. So it's a little more humid here. I also keep them in a basement. So that also adds to the humidity and, you know, it's cooler and more humid down here than it would be if I was keeping them, you know, upstairs, or if I was like in a two-story house or keeping them in an attic or something. My husbandry would be different than it is having them in the basement. I just had to turn the heater on. Well, actually I had taken it out of the basement, so I had to move it back in, turn it on, cause it was starting to dip a little bit into the mid-60s at night. And, I got one of those, LCD kind of like thermometers that will tell me what the humidity is, what the temperature is, but it also tracks the high and the low. So I know what the warmest it's gotten in the room while I haven't been here and what the lowest is. So when I saw it kind of dipping below 68, I was like, all right, it's time to move the heater in. And as soon as you do that, you know, like you were mentioning, you notice the humidity all of a sudden starts taking a nosedive. Mm-hmm. So I have a cool water humidifier, you know, that I set up down here, because that helps my snakes a lot more than anything. Because, you know, they need a certain level of humidity to get a good molt. And I was noticing that last winter, they would be shedding fine until the heater really starts getting cold outside, and I got that heater running a lot, and then they were just having some bad sheds. So, you know, I invested in one of those humidifiers that just kind of turns on itself on and off based on what it kind of reads the temperature or the humidity of the room. And that's helped out my entire collection a lot.
Yeah, for sure.
So it's one of those things that, you know, I can tell you what, how I do it, but you're going to have to take that information and maybe also pull from a few other reliable sources and then take all of that and adapt it to your situation, you know? And I think more people should be, you know, saying that kind of stuff publicly, you know, because I don't want to say it's hero worship, but there is some kind of like people assume because you've got a camera pointed at you and you're talking about it, that you're some kind of authority and that everything you say should be taken literally and is the truth across the board. And I get frustrated when somebody's like, well, you shouldn't do it that way because Richard says to do it this way. And I'm like, well, no, Richard says, Richard does it this way. Yeah. Other people can do it what works best for them, because, you know, my method is not universal. You know, I'm just trying to share my experience with you, not tell you what to do.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and you mentioned it before, like a lot of care sheets that haven't engaged with the animals before, just look at the local temperature in the area where that animal's from. Like the whip spiders are from Tanzania, so they must love it super hot. And it's like, well, actually the animals can regulate, and there's certain areas, pockets within caves or in termite mounds, I think is where they are usually found. And that stays regulated at like 70 degrees because it's underground, like a little hobbit hole. And so just looking at the weather in an area and being like, or the, you know, general climate and being like, well, this must be what they need. These animals are able to go up, down in the trees, underground, in logs, in areas. Probably a lot of them have diapause and other like seasonal stop working kind of mechanisms so that they can survive climate shifts. And so, yeah, definitely there's an optimal temperature to keep your animals at. But if you have a power outage, there's some species that might be able to be just fine. So be sure to focus your heat packs or whatever else you have on the animals that are going to need it. And don't be like completely amazed that, yeah, I've had that problem. We had a power outage one of the Christmases and ended up coming home, and everything had done great except one Pokey Metallica, the light below him had been causing the air to circulate correctly, and that light didn't turn back on after the power outage, and I didn't notice. It's the only spider I've ever lost. It was my only lost tarantula. But yeah, it's just the rest, everybody else did great with just that short moment of cold. And that's when I was just like, ghost mantises, everybody should have these are the amazingly hardy animals. But yeah. It's not something I wanted to experience. I definitely rushed home from Northern Idaho. I had a caretaker that was checking stuff, but you know, you have so many thermostats going. I found out that one of my thermostat brands does not reset after a power outage. The other ones do.
Oh, I think I got that same one.
Yeah. The one that's like $2 cheaper.
Yeah.
And now it's in the garbage can. But yeah, there's definitely, you know, you don't experience it until I've kind of now this summer we had some power outages just due to like high heat electricity concerns. And I was like, good, I get to test this out in the summer. What isn't going to turn back on and like get a plan going for next seasonal catastrophe.
Yeah. Yeah, I have. I've probably got 12 different thermostats just in my collection, and one of them. And it looks very similar to all the other ones, but when the power goes off and comes back on, it just kind of like, it's back to like 72 degrees or something like that, something really low. And I can never remember which one it is. So I have to like check all of them every time. And then I get paranoid. I find it. I'm like, well, let me just double check all the other ones actually reset.
Yeah, that feeling. Yep. I wrote a big note to myself on the back of it and put it up in the like emergency animal stuff. Like if I need a thermostat, cause I need to like set something up real quick, but not as like a regular thermostat.
I should replace it. Yeah, no, I'm just kind of a cheapskate.
Like I said, it's around still. I just don't. Yeah.
And there was one of my, I guess it was my first tarantula ever. I got it when I was 18. Mm-hmm. So it was probably 10 years later. I was living in West Virginia again, and was thinking about moving to Daytona Beach, Florida. And this was like February. I guess my girlfriend at the time, we were living together. She had family down there. So we were going to go down there for a week and stay, look for an apartment, and just kind of like decide if that's where we wanted to move or not. And while we were down there, something happened. And I don't know what happened exactly, but the power was off for like when we came home, there was no power.
Yeah.
It was a crappy garage apartment. And I think it just tripped the breaker or blew a fuse. It was probably fuses. That's how crappy the apartment was. And so I like I walked in and was like, man, it's really cold in here. You could see your breath. The water in the toilet was frozen. I was like, oh no, this is not good. So I rushed to the tarantula, and of course, you know, this was, you know, I don't even know what year this was, probably 2005-ish, maybe 2008, something like that, maybe earlier. And it was, I just didn't know a lot about tarantulas, so I actually had a heat rock in there. Wow. I don't even remember those things. I don't even know if they sell them anymore. It seems like nobody suggests using them for anything, but there was a heat rock in there, and the tarantula was essentially just trying to keep itself warm on the heat rock. And that thing, that didn't work. It wasn't producing enough heat to even. So that was how my first tarantula died. I was out of town. I didn't have anybody checking on it, and the power went out, and it got too cold for it. But it's, you know, it was heartbreaking, and you know, it was my mistake. I really should have had somebody checking in on the place, but I learned from that. So now even if I'm like just leaving for the weekend, I get somebody to come by, you know, at least, cause I know, you know, they're going to be fine, you know, for a weekend, but at least check, make sure all the heat lights are on for the snakes and you know, everything's as it should be. And occasionally it seems like, I've talked about this before, but my, I guess it was this past summer, my kid's grandmother would come by and check on the dogs and the cats and, you know, everything like that. And a scorpion had gotten out and she had to, a poor old lady had to, you know, capture that for me. I felt really bad.
It sounded like she handled it very well.
She did. Yeah. She is a trooper. She won't touch the snakes, but she has got no problem scooping up a scorpion.
That's everybody. It's so weird. I don't know the fear that people lock on to like the movement or the build of one thing, like arachnophobes are fine with snakes and vice versa. And you just, it's just that innate. I mean, I've always equated it. I think I have all those like fear responses, but it's like all of the happiness instead of fear, which is interesting. So it's like, I get the same rush, but it's like a positive version of it, which I always, explain as fascination through fear. Like you just still get that rush, but without all of the negativity.
Yeah. And a lot of times the more you learn about something, the less scary it becomes. Cause I think a lot of my fear, at least with spiders initially, was just, I didn't understand them. I didn't know anything about them. There was just a lot of of fear of the unknown and worst case scenarios in my mind. And then the more I learned about them, the more I was like, these things are not nearly as bad as I thought they were, you know? And that's actually kind of, I've been transitioning the past few days actually, with like, as far as like promoting a video or something like that, I've been kind of playing around with actually trying to get a video in front of the eyes of somebody that identifies as an arachnophobe with the, you know, like, hey, I was arachnophobe. I was, you know, deathly afraid of spiders. And this type of like exposure to them and learning about them helped me overcome that fear, you know? So maybe you should try that.
Yeah. I mean, how that goes. Yeah. I use you as an example pretty often. A lot of people in the tarantula hobby seem to have that same story. Like the fear kind of turned into like almost an obsession. Like once the fear was gone, the interest was excessive, which is great. Yeah. I was just wondering, you mentioned when you film, you feel like you're, tarantulas kind of wait for you to leave the room, whether or not you've been waiting forever or not, you know, that they'd molt if you weren't watching them, kind of a thing. But when I observe a tarantula molting, he seems flipped and like he can't see in any way and engaging. Do you feel like your tarantulas can tell your presence is there? Like you spend a lot of time just kind of observing them. Do you feel like they can see you without sight, if that makes sense? Do you think they can feel like determine your presence even when you're being really still? I've always wondered that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that they can tell when I walk into a room, you know, like, I'll come down because the way my basement's set up, you know, I come down these steps, and from the steps I can like look out, especially the way I kind of rearranged everything. I can see everything behind me because the steps are like right over. Wait. Yeah. They're right over there. So the tarantulas are over here for people watching the video. And I can see just like by coming down the steps and looking at them, a lot of them are out and they feel the movement of the air, you know, and they just take off and go run and hide. And yeah. And when it's molting, I don't know if they it might just be bad luck, but it seems like I'll and it could also be the light. Cause when I'm filming a tarantula molting, a lot of the times I have to add additional light because the light that I have above their enclosure is just like a very dim LED light. Sometimes like when you are looking at, you know, one of my videos, they kind of seem bright, but as far as, your ability to record something on video, it's not nearly as bright. It's, you know, it's not bright enough to get a good shot. So I have to add additional lights, like LED, like essentially like filming lights. I'll put on top of the enclosure or outside the enclosure, you know, directed on the tarantula so that there's enough light to get a good image on the camera. And I think that increase of light could also kind of set them, you know, on edge. So they just lay there and don't molt or, you know, don't feed or don't walk around or whatever it is that I want them to do so I can catch it on film. They just, all that additional light kind of freaks them out. And then, you know, whether I have to move the enclosure a little bit or remove them from the enclosure, if I'm trying to get a video of them, like, you know, just walking around or something, like, I think that also kind of puts them on edge and freaks them out a little bit. But even in those situations where I set that stuff up and I'll sit there for a long time, not moving, you know, trying to be as still as possible, I think that they can still sense me. And there's no scientific evidence or backing to this at all. It's just my opinion, my feelings. But I think even just me breathing, you know, just that small amount, even if I'm sitting perfectly still, just the inhale and exhale is creating enough movement of air molecules that they're, you know, possibly they're able to sense that and know that there's, you know, that big weird guy with the red beard is watching me right now. You know what I mean?
You'd think they'd be used to it. Yeah. My dad, he was always a hunter and, you know, backwoods, and he's an ER doctor, OB, you know, doctor minded person, very not hocus pocus, but when he was hunting, he feels like there's just that, the eyes on the back of your neck example that, you know, everybody's kind of, even culturally, we've kind of talked about, but never really wondered. And so I kind of bring that into my mantis care. Like when I'm trying to pair two mantises, like I feel like leaving the room is going to be the easiest way because they're both kind of focused. And I've actually, when I was working with Ambulopygi, and I actually set up like a nanny cam and was just upstairs watching the nanny cam to make sure nothing bad happened. Cause I just, like you said, even just the movement of air from breathing, I feel like they're just so in tune to, especially a species that has that kind of sensory organs. But, and another thing that I read it in the Ambulopygi book by Oren, but they supposedly Ambulopygi wait for their food to molt. And I was like, okay, you know, maybe they eat food that has molted in preference. And so people see that and assume they were waiting, but that seems like a little bit of extra effort. Like how could an insect or an arthropod know that if it waits, something will be better? That just seems like a little bit of a jump to me. And then I had that exact experience with one of my Ambulopygi. I'd had a feeder in there for so long that I was like, maybe I should take it out. The Ambulopygi is not close to molting, but like maybe it needs something new. And then the next day the feeder had molted and the Ambulopygi was eating it the moment it had molted. And it just blew my mind because I had totally read that and kind of discredited it as, you know, what are you talking about? And then it happened in my collection like a week later. So
and when you say Ambulopygi, for those that aren't familiar with the scientific name, you're referring to tailless whip scorpions.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, the tailless whip spider, Harry Potter spider, tailless whip scorpion, all the, it's got a lot of names. I think Ambulopygi is adorable.
My favorite is the Taylor Swift scorpion.
Oh no. Because people hear it wrong, or like their yeah, text like, corrects them. It's like, you must mean Taylor Swift. Yeah, they were one of the species that definitely started the ambassadorship. Like they're so nasty looking, and then when you meet one, you're like, oh, you are just the most scared, want to be out of any danger. Like they'll pump a threat display if they need to. They'll do a threat display and pretend that they're the biggest thing in the world, but they're looking for an out the whole time. And they're just, yeah, they're an amazing, if you want a species like no other, there's some of the Florida whips that are really easy to care for. The Diademe and the other Tanzanian species seem to be hit or miss because they're all wild caught. And there's just those concerns. You can do the exact same thing with three animals and one will have parasitic issues from originally and things like that, but really highly recommended as far as an animal to engage with.
Yeah. And determining what species you have seems to be difficult. Like, I was sold a tailless whip scorpion and was told this is a Tanzanian tailless whip scorpion, I believe. And it was, you know, I bought it from someone I don't know at a reptile show. I never really heard of them. And they were the only ones that had any on their table. And I was like, this is my opportunity. And I wanted to pay for shipping, so I want to pick it up. And I brought it home, made a video about it. And during my research, you know, before I even made a video, you know, I'm like, I want to keep this for a while, make sure I'm doing it right. So I did all my research. I wasn't having, like, it was thriving in its enclosure. But I kept delaying making the video because I couldn't get a solid answer as to what species it was. You know, I'd reach out to some people that, I mean, I wouldn't say they're self-proclaimed experts, but like, I felt like they would know a lot more about this species than I would. And I'd send them pictures and they would say, oh, this is definitely the species. And then somebody else would be like, no, it's not that species. It's this species. And I was just going back and forth and was getting really frustrated. And finally I was like, I'm going to make the video and inevitably somebody's going to watch it. That's going to know more than me and they will correct me. And you know what? What's crazy is that that didn't happen. Like nobody has, a couple of people said it's not that species. And I'm like, well, what species is it then? Please help me. And they're like, oh, I don't know. I just know it's not a D. diadema. And then I saw Alex from Tarantula Haven. Tarantula Haven was having the same issue with his, just trying to determine exactly what species it is. And it's one of those, you know, they're not new to the hobby, but they're not nearly as popular as a lot of tarantulas and isopods and stuff like that. So I think as their popularity increases, there will be more people and more information available, which is like the exciting thing about kind of being in the invert hobby is that there's a lot of species out there that are just kind of like on the fringe that are gaining. And like the more you put that information out there or even just pictures and videos about them, more people get interested in them. More people end up adding them to their collection. There becomes more of a need for good information. And then that stuff, you know, it starts surfacing in a way that's a lot easier to find, I guess.
Yeah. And matching the experts with the hobby seems like the gap right now. There's so many entomologists that are total experts, but they don't engage in a way that the hobby can access that. Definitely. One of the examples is just as simple as the mantis question. Like Snake Discovery did a video and she's like, is it mantises or mantids? And Ed looks it up and he's like, oh, it's both. And the mantis person I know is just like face palming because it's mantids is a group, is a genus within mantises. So all mantises, including ghost mantises, are mantises, but a certain group of mantises are mantids, if you ask an entomologist. But everybody else is going to just say whatever comes to mind first, which is, you know, fine until the entomologists come nitpicking and they're like, that's not that species. That's not how you say that. I know with the whip spiders, it's like the difference between one or two tines on their pedipalps. They've got like, whether the tines are like this or like this kind of a thing is the difference in the species. I bought a Tanzanian as it was marked and it came in, it was a Florida whip scorpion. So, which are about like an inch long. And I contacted them and was like, you didn't send me what I ordered. And I posted it getting excited because I was brand new to the hobby and somebody totally was just like, noob, what? No, that's not what that is. And got super embarrassed about that. And I still have one of the ones because I had them, I ordered four and I was like, can I keep one just as a like, sorry. And then they like used my photo that I took of the animals to prove what species it was on their website to sell it. I called them. I was like, can you photo credit me or something? But it was just a really messy interaction. The whole thing was just like, if you don't know what you're selling, just post a picture of it and let the buyer find out if you're not willing to do it yourself. But yeah, that was also my first like buying things online on the invert hobby. I was like, oh boy, this is going to be a roller coaster.
Yeah. There's some sellers out there that can be a little difficult to work with, I guess. That's something that, I'll say frustration. Like, because I really like taking photos and, you know, I spend a lot of money on lenses and cameras and lights and all that stuff. And a lot of time, I mean, to get one photo that I feel like is Instagram worthy, I guess you could say, or that I'll post publicly, I'd probably take 100 photos. Maybe that might be an exaggeration, but I'll take a lot of photos and kind of have to go through and find which one the lighting was good and the flash was working and lit up what I wanted, but wasn't overexposed or underexposed. And then you edit the photos in Photoshop and stuff like that, try to bring out the shadows, or, you know, there's a lot of work that goes into a photo, and then you post it. And then a week later, you see some website has it up there for their care guide or trying to sell their species. And it's like, hey, I spent a lot of time on that photo. Like, and technically, it posted and copyrighted, you know, you could at least give me some credit for it. And that's actually something I've been looking at, because it's really hard to kind of monetize that, or, you know, to get people to even give you credit, let alone pay for it. So, like, I've been actually looking at posting a lot of, or like licensing them through my photos through like Shutterstock or Getty Images and places like that, where they'll pretty much handle it. You know what I mean? Like, you got to pay them, and you only get a percentage of it, but at least it'd be some kind of income to kind of essentially, and not even like a profit. It would just be offsetting the expense of all these cameras and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, just being given the credit to take all that time to get those photos is in itself just respectful. I had one of the funniest examples of this. Somebody on eBay wanted to trade with me. They wanted some mantises. And so they're like, oh, just look at my collection, see what you want. We can trade something. And I looked, and they were using my Hoffman's Eggy isopod photo from my Instagram that's not Arthropods Ambassadors. I have a quail in the city as well that has some stuff. So they had stolen my photo and then asked me to trade insects, not knowing it was me. And so I was like, well, first of all, I don't even know if you have these animals because you're using my photos. And I never heard back from them. They were very embarrassed, just went into the wood grain. But yeah.
And I've done that myself. Like, I was making it was a post about the one, it was some huntsman spider that I had received, and I just had a very tiny sling, and I just did a quick Google search and pulled up a picture of what it looked like full grown. And it wasn't like I wasn't trying to sell it or promote a video or anything like that. It was just kind of I just got this spider in. Here's what it looks like as, you know, a very young kind of spiderling. This is what it will look like when it's older. And it was just like a paragraph about some information about, like, just an interesting fact about the spider. And posted it, and then whoever took that picture sent me an email, and they were very rude and very upset that I was using their photo. And, you know, I'm sensitive to that, so I actually like did some research when I was like, I'm going to use this photo, and like reverse searched it through Google Images trying to find who actually took the photo. And it was like all over Pinterest and Facebook and Reddit, and, you know what I mean, there was like the photo had been used, you know, probably almost 100 times. No watermark, and I couldn't determine who the original photographer was. So I was like, all right, well, I feel like I've done my due diligence. It wasn't, and I spent, you know, 15 minutes trying to discover who this person is, and I didn't. So I am giving up and just want to post it because apparently they don't care.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I was gentle. I was like, just a photo credit. I didn't get too upset. I was like, hey. And then they got weird about like, well, what do you mean? And I was like, well, if you don't know how to photo credit, you probably shouldn't be running a website. But yeah, I tried to look from their point of view, who knows where they got it from. And both times I was like, by the way, that is mine. And then they just kind of ghost, just like, oh no.
Yeah. I think a lot of times people just assume like it's on the internet, it's a photo, I'm just going to use it. Like it doesn't hurt anybody. You know, and it doesn't, it's not that it hurts anybody, I guess, but it is a little frustrating when you're the person that spent a lot. I mean, it's kind of like artwork or something, you know, you spend a lot of time getting that. But I think some people just don't know how to get good pictures, especially if they don't have a camera and they're just using their phone. Sometimes it can be very difficult to get a picture of a tarantula, or even more so like a mantis or an isopod. So you're like, well, I know I have that species, so I find a picture of it and just use it. And it doesn't even cross their mind that somebody took that picture, and it's a small hobby. So it's probably somebody you're going to be interacting with.
Yeah.
You know, and I apologize to the guy. I was like, look, I'm sorry. I tried to find out who you were. It wasn't readily available. So, I'll be more than happy to give you credit. Just give me your information. And in that case though, just their response, like they were just kind of, I don't want to use profanity, but
they were huffy.
They were a jerk. And I was just kind of like, you know what? screw the whole thing. I'm just going to delete the posts everywhere. And you know, I would have been more than happy to give you credit, but you were kind of a jerk about it. Even after I explained where I was coming from, like I wasn't, and their big thing was like, you're using it to make money. And I'm like, no, like Facebook posts are not monetized. Reddit posts are not monetized. Like I didn't make a video on it. I'm not selling them. Like there was no money exchange there. So like, I don't understand where you're coming from with that accusation. But so I just deleted the whole thing.
It seems like when people are mad, they're arguing with you about what they think you did and they don't want to actually hear the other side of the conversation. It's pretty common currently to just, yeah, argue with what you think somebody's about to say, and it's not going to engage the conversation in a way that you'll grow in any way. And it's just going to attack them to shut down. But yeah. And I love the art I've gotten, and it's some of it's in my art, in my bug room. And when I'm filming, it's like, do I avoid it or do I give it credit in some way? Like I have one of the Tetraceras does some really adorable art for tarantulas. Really brings to life like how adorable they are. And so every time I swing by, it's like, should I mention that artwork or should I just like scoot the camera up and over just to be able to give everybody the credit they need.
One thing we were talking about before we started recording the podcast, it's a aspect of the hobby that I've kind of been struggling with. Like I got two different species of assassin bugs, and one of them's seemingly pretty successful. The other one is struggling. And, you know, I was told when I got them, and I'm not throwing anybody under the bus because I don't think they were like intentionally giving me bad information or anything. Cause I heard actually from multiple sources, people were like, these are pretty easy to take care of and they're prolific breeders. So, you know, you get like a small starter colony of like five or six, within a year, you're going to be trying to give them away, if not sell them, because you're going to have so many of them. And I have not had any, luck really with breeding with them, like just breeding. So do you keep assassin bugs? And if so, can you share some of your experience, please?
Yeah, we ended up with the assassin bugs at one of the shows, and I think they're very underrated. They're amazing. They're very focused sight-based predators. So they're just really interesting to watch engage, and they're really good in a communal. And I have always found that fascinating. Something is so brutish and aggressive towards its prey, just being able to interact with another thing like it so well. So I love the assassins for that. But yeah, we have the assassins and we love them. The white spots seem to be the easiest to care for. That's what we're overrun with. And I currently just keep them in a 2-gallon fish tank. I have all of their runoff colony are in another enclosure. And there's two adults that live just under this cork bark. But this, I feel like the success comes with a little bit of ignoring them. And so I allow them to dry out and then get moist again. I've noticed there've been like issues with mold on the egg capsules themselves. So even if they're breeding, their egg capsules aren't working. And if you look in the hobby, definitely the horrid kings are super expensive, which always suggests to me that there might be a trick or two that keep them a little bit more rare. And so I've been having problems with my horrid kings as well. I've got a lot of eggs coming now, but it was after I set them up kind of like I do my roaches. And so I have them in a large enclosure with a heat strip under one side so that they can thermoregulate, and then kind of moist on the other side. I feel like they're a little more tropical than the 2-spot. But yeah, I've definitely been getting a lot of little ones. And like I said, they're just such an engaging species that's so different from any of the tarantulas or any of the mantises in a way that I think that they're a great ambassador. I haven't been bit yet, and I've heard horror stories, so I'm avoiding it at all costs. I've heard that they're one of the rethink keeping inverts sort of bites. So I definitely wouldn't suggest cuddling with them, but as far as watching their interaction, they're amazing. But yeah, I missed once or twice a week, but allow it to dry in between sessions. They will kind of extend their proboscis and drink. I love telling people, technically, they are the only bug in my collection. So bugs are a group of insects that have the sucking mouthpieces and a couple other order things. So any aphids and a lot of the stink bugs and a lot of assassins and things like that are the only thing that actually qualify as bugs if you ask an entomologist. So I've got a lot of insects. I've got a lot of arthropods. I don't have very many bugs. But then bugs is also the umbrella term most people use. So bugs in cyberspace, things like that. But Yeah, yeah. The assassins are great. I find that they seem to attract a group of people that when you're at an expo, there seems like frat-esque younger men really like the assassins. I've got a few friends that are, you know, college techie nerds that have an assassin on their desk and absolutely love it, whereas they wouldn't think twice about owning any of the other species. And I'm currently not really sure on their lifespan. These guys are at like 2.5 years and ticking, and I've been told they shouldn't live that long. So we're figuring that out before we do the care sheet, like always.
Yeah. Yeah, mine are at 1 year now, almost exact. Well, they were obviously alive before I got them, because some of them, I got a mixture of, I think there were a few adults and then some juveniles, and maybe a few nymphs. And they've been like my white spotted ones. They're thriving. Like I think all of them are still doing well. Maybe lost one, but I haven't had any babies yet, which is kind of frustrating for me because I was really wanting to grow the colony. My horde kings have just kind of slowly been dying off. I'm down to two. I think I had five originally, four or five, something like that. So if you end up having some successful eggs hatch and you decide you want to sell some, definitely keep me in mind. I would like to pick some up.
I actually have some of the horde king eggs because I'm trying a couple. When I'm not having success, I just split stuff around and try a couple different things. And so one of the things I'm trying is at the bottom in the cocoa fiber in the enclosure that I'm incubating the orchid mantis ooths. And so they're in with some springtails to keep the mold contained, a little bit higher heat and high humidity. And then there's some that I'm leaving just with the adults. There's another enclosure that I'm not getting as humid as often. So yeah, I mean, the hobby is so small that we kind of have to be citizen scientists and split up our ways, I think. But are you seeing the little tiny egg capsules in the white spots yet? Because they do take a little while to hatch.
No, not that I've noticed. I'll have to go look after the podcast. Yeah, I haven't seen anything while I've been in there that looked like eggs. And definitely no, you know, nymphs or, you know, anything very small moving around. Which is why I've been frozen. Because I thought I had talked to somebody else and they're like, well, you know, maybe the substrate is too moist. And so, you know, but I'm like, I don't even see eggs. But, you know, I'm not an expert. That's why I haven't made a video on those guys yet. Because it's like, I want to have at least some successful eggs hatch. So I know like, all right, so I must be giving them at least good enough environment that they're able to breed successfully. Mm-hmm. So until that happens, you know, I'll take pictures of them, but that's about it. We'll wait for the husbandry video until I've figured out exactly how to do that.
Yeah. You might try to flush them with the food too. Just throw in a bunch of red or whatever feeders you use. And I know the crickets can be dangerous during a molt, but if you're in a colony like that, if one isn't picked up by one, it'll be picked up by the other. So it's not quite as much of a concern. So maybe like throw in enough feeders that they're not finished by the next day and then pull stuff out and just make sure that they're overfed.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah, I make sure with any of my communals that there's plenty of food, whether they're scorpions, tarantulas, or you know, the assassin bugs.
Yeah.
One of the cool things with the assassin bugs that I've noticed is that sometimes they'll share food, or, you know, like they'll each have one end of a cricket or a roach, and occasionally they'll like fight over it, but they don't harm each other while they're fighting over it. They just kind of wrestle back and forth, and one walks off with the cricket while the other one goes hunting for prey again.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things about them. And I'm one of the people on the M. balfouri communal list. And that's my obsession with them, is watching tarantulas like have a conversation about who wins. They just like, they'll like elevate over each other and be like,
yeah,
very democratic for a tarantula.
Communals are fascinating. And it's one of my favorite. I think that's why I kind of expanded outside of tarantulas, is I knew that M. balfouri was about the only one people have had consistent success with. Like, there's some other species people have kept communally, but when you move beyond M. balfouri, the success rate seems to drop drastically. Like, some people keep P. metallicas communally with no issues, and then other people end up with one really fat spider. So, you know, it's one of those things that I know that there are some species of scorpions that just in the wild live communally. So that's what, it's kind of what got me into scorpions initially, is I wanted to have another communal in my collection. And I went with the Florida bark scorpions, and there's some other species, but I try to stay away from scorpions that are like super hot. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I don't want anything that's way too venomous. But yeah, communals are very interesting. And I wish, you know, there were more species that you know, had that kind of communal capability. But I think that's also why I got really into bioactives, because I like the fact that you could have springtails and isopods and living with tarantulas or scorpions or, you know, some other kind of invert or reptile.
Yeah. I mean, my first tarantulas, I started on the deep end. I did the thing you're not supposed to do. And I was at a show and I had P. metallicas on my maybe list if I ever thought about getting tarantulas. And the guy had them and he was keeping the slings communally. And so I was like, do you have any P. metallica? And he turns around this enclosure and they're all cuddling together. And my like heart just was like, oh, that's the cutest thing. And so I got three of those because that's all I could afford. And I had them together for a while. And one of them just seemed to be on the other side of the cage, not engaging with the others. And so I took that one out thinking, you know, if you're not engaging, maybe you're being chased away. But the other two are still in their enclosure. They're in a 10-gallon above me. And the male matured a while ago. And he's my little cricket. He's drumming all night long. And the female just molted to probably maturity. And he's really annoying with her. And I've been trying to, like, tong feed her because she's still post-molt skinny. And he's putting himself in danger every day. And I should separate him if I would suggest separating to another person. But she's been doing good with him. And I've been able to get her to eat a roach or two, so I'm not quite as worried. And it seems to me, I did a lot of research on it, and it seems like the split between whether or not you can keep them communally seems to be whether or not you're in the US or the UK. I think that they're cheaper and more common there in a way that people have taken that risk. And here it's just not worth dropping that money and hoping. So that seems like point. What I saw when I saw people really adamant both ways is like, well, are you from the US or are you from the UK? Not that you should put animals in danger, but it sounds like it works, except every once in a while, but that every once in a while isn't worth it when it's $90 a spider.
Very true. And that's one of the downfalls or blind spots, I think, in our hobby is that people are very eager to share their successes and very reluctant to share failures. So somebody will try it out and it not work, and then they just never mention it again because they don't want to be the person that admits that I lost half of my collection or half the communal from cannibalism or worse. But if somebody is successful, then, you know, they're making videos and posts and, you know, sharing pictures like nonstop. Mm-hmm. So it kind of it's not an accurate representation of reality. And people begin to think, well, you know, this species must be communal because all I'm seeing is success stories. And it's like, well, that doesn't necessarily mean it's has the highest or the success rate that you think it does. Because mm-hmm. a lot of people out there are losing tarantulas to cannibalism or, you know, whatever species of invert they got. They're just not telling you about it.
Well, and just allowing that tarantula to tell you, like I said, I was observing the communal and one of them did not seem to be part of it. So I removed him. And I've seen a pokey Pisilotheria breeding video where the male was definitely like, let me out of this enclosure. What are you doing? And the owner was like, we'll see what happens in the morning. And it was dead in the morning. But I like just knowing body language and seeing that male tarantula, who are usually very annoying, being like, please let me out. I was like, maybe, yeah, I would have made a different decision. And that's definitely an example of what can happen. But yeah, I think that the hobby should definitely be a safer space for people to explain their negative situations just so that we can all learn, because that's going to be the most positive in the future.
I agree 100%. And it's a shame that, you know, you can't be, because it's a lot of this is new, you know, like people haven't been keeping tarantulas and stuff like that for hundreds of years as pets, you know, like maybe dogs or cats or something like that, thousands of years. So there needs to be some room for experimentation, in my opinion. You know, like I set up this paludarium bioactive enclosure for a Carabina versicolor. And, you know, it's not a traditional enclosure. You know, it's got like a fish tank in the bottom, essentially. And I got a beta living and then like a small area of, you know, I made a whole video on it. And I honestly expected to get a lot harsher criticism than I did. I was like, you know, I'm doing this and people are going to lose their minds because it's not a traditional enclosure for this species. So I was like ready for a lot of backlash for whatever reason, maybe just didn't get on the right people's radar. Those people have already unfollowed me or something. So I didn't get the negative comments I was kind of anticipating, but it's like, I wanted to try it out. You know, I wanted, cause I had seen some people post pictures and, you know, kind of just discussions about different ways of keeping navicularias and carabinas. And they were essentially, what they did is, like, they used a really large water dish, or they didn't have any substrate at all. And they just, like, had a couple of inches of water in the bottom of the enclosure. Cause, you know, the tarantulas just didn't really go down to the floor of the enclosure very often. And then they got ridiculed. And I was like, you know, maybe they're onto something though. Like, you know, we won't find the best way to keep something if we don't do some experiments. And I'm not saying like something like way out on, you know, and way out of left field, but kind of like, you know, just trying something new. And if it doesn't work, then, you know, admit that it didn't work and why it didn't work, and go back to what is proven. But if we all just get set in our ways and into that rut, then, you know, we're not going to grow as keepers, or, you know, in the hobby. You know, sometimes you got to do a little of experimentation or a little bit of alteration, and see if it works. If it works, like, so far, it's been working out well. Like, the tarantula seems, she's eaten, she's making herself at home. Things are going well, and you know, but the first sign of some issues, like if it's just too humid in there, or it just doesn't seem like it's comfortable, you know, or its health is deteriorating, then I will definitely take it out, put it into more traditional type of enclosure. But, you know, it's one of those things that I wanted to try it out, because I thought it would be a kind of cool biodiverse enclosure where, you know, it's from, you know, a kind of a humid tropical area. That's the environment that's inside here. But I also wanted to make sure to give it that ability to escape the heat or the humidity, you know, like it would in the wild.
Yeah, and definitely with the bioactive tanks, it's kind of getting into fish culture sort of concerns, where you need things to cycle. So you need you don't just need to add springtails, but you need them to be a springtail population that has been dealing with mold in a way that they're ready for it. So a lot of cycling things that aquaculture takes into concern starts needing to be taken into concern with bioactive cultures. So setting up a tank that is ready for a concern instead of, and that kind of stuff needs to be looked into more. So you could say, yeah, I set up this tank and it didn't work, but is it because just needed 10, 20% more springtails so that something didn't bloom or things like that? So I feel like, yeah, even there's so many differences in how those tanks can go that saying whether or not it worked is definitely not definitive. Like, keep working on it. But if you can keep dart frogs and stuff like fancy stuff like that, I feel like there's ways to keep fungal issues down. So which dart frogs are surprisingly easy and fun if, like I said, this tank is cycling correctly.
Yeah, I had I was concerned, like, I didn't want to just like rush into this and it become a failure and then like that be on video and people just assume, okay, this isn't going to work at all because Richard wasn't able to do it. So I essentially, and I think it frustrated they weren't really a sponsor of the video, but ZooMed had sent me some stuff to use in the enclosure. And you know, when they do something like that, they want to make sure that you're actually using the stuff, and wanted a video so the guy that sent it to me could show his boss, like, and justify sending me, you know, some free cork bark and whatever it was they sent, a tank heater and like a water heater and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So he was like, where's the video? And I'm like, well, it's going to be like a few more weeks, man, because like I'm doing this very slowly. I'm setting up the enclosure, filling up the water, getting that. You know, I wanted to make sure before I even put the betta fish or any kind of living animal in the water that, you know, the levels had kind of like, you know, hit their optimal. I just want to make sure everything was perfect. And then I'll move the fish in, yeah. You know, and then once that's stabilized, then we'll work on the plants and get that going. And once the plants have rooted and are growing and they're not going to die within a week or two, once they're established, then we'll, you know, it was steps. And I was like, is this going to be like 6-8 weeks? You know, you just got to be patient with me. I want to make sure I do it right. You know, so I moved in isopods and springtails and let them kind of get established and make sure, you know, and the whole time I'm checking humidity levels and temperature levels. And it just was like an empty enclosure that was slowly being built over weeks. And then when I was comfortable that everything had was stabilized and, you know, it was consistent, you know, the humidity was within an acceptable range and stuff like that. Then it's like, all right, now we'll move in the tarantula and, you know, and go from there. And I told people when I put out the video, like, if this doesn't work, I'm going to definitely be one to tell you, because I don't want somebody watching this video and making the same mistake I did, you know. And you know, there needs to be more of that out there. Occasionally you see somebody that will try a communal with like, what was it? Neothelia yense. There was a lot of people that were like, this is a communal species of tarantula. And then it ended up not being, because they went from like 10 tarantulas to 3 tarantulas really quick. And other people have had success. Like I wouldn't keep them communally. I don't keep them communally, but I know some people have had varying rates of success with them. But you know, it's one of those things that we got to, we got to share our successes and our failures equally. That's the only way that we'll learn and grow as a hobby.
Mm-hmm. And that's how I feel about the ghost mantises. They're everywhere plastered online says communal. And I do keep large groups together, well fed, and they do pretty well. But once they're adult females, they're as mantis gets. They want to eat everything that moves. And so everything you see online for the cares, they're a great communal species. And I've definitely, if you have enough of them to not mind a loss, a lot of cannibals I see start, two mantises will lock onto the same feeder. And they will just start eating, and whoever makes it to the other mantis first wins. So yeah, you'll definitely find communals that there's mess ups that people are, the cats have been the best by far. These guys are just fantastic at communal. I've really been impressed, but most communal mantises it just means they prefer smaller prey. It doesn't mean they like hanging out together. Whereas the Balfouris are actually interacting in a social capacity. So I would call that communal, and then the other one be more like can house together, but they might not.
Yeah. They're not so much communal as they are tolerant.
Yeah. They'd prefer something smaller to eat, but you know, when they need something to eat, they're going to find something to eat. They're still able to navigate their reality, but.
So you've got a YouTube channel where you discuss a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about today. You have like care videos, or what kind of content can people expect to find on your channel?
I've been comparing different species mantis as I have them. As I mentioned, I feel like my care on ghosts is pretty dialed in, but I haven't really made, I've been asked about making cat care videos, but as far as I've gotten is just, this is where I'm keeping them. My YouTube is very looking at the animal the entire time and not very much of me talking. And a lot of times it's just bringing something out to see how it moves. Cause when I started looking into YouTube, that's what I kind of wanted, was just, I want to see how this animal moves and how this animal interacts to being handled. And beyond that, like, I can look up what you're talking about, sort of thing. So they're very short videos. Every video I learn something new about editing. And then I have my hands in there handling the insects. I'll compare, like, one of my last ones was communal mantises. So I say, you know, this is a ghost mantis. Sometimes they don't work very well as communals. These are cryptic mantises. They work a lot better. And then these are cat mantises. These are my favorite as a communal from what I've experienced. So just a lot of the like quick topics under 5 minutes, just get that idea out into the world so that people can learn before they engage fully by getting one of those animals. And then I just use my hands. I have like one video with my face in it. Cause I kind of wanted to avoid just all the extra comments about me. I just want to talk about the animals. And even that has been unavoidable because I used to be working on a farm that I had these calluses and these dirt that just was fused into my skin. And so, you know, 30% of the comments are like, what's wrong with your hands? It's like, I was trying to avoid this by not having my face, and it's still, people can't help themselves. So, but yeah, that's most of my YouTube.
Yeah, that's the internet though. People like making comments that have nothing to do with the video. Like I get some strange comments as well, but I think it's a little different because I'm a guy. Like I've noticed it seems females get a lot more critical comments on YouTube about appearance than guys do. Like I get comments about my beard. That's about it. So I feel for you. And I had the same issue. Like my day job, I work a lot with precious metals, and one of the things that you have to do to test if something is gold or gold plated or brass or whatever is use nitric acid. And so I have to drip nitric acid on different metals throughout the day. And inevitably some of it gets on the tips of my fingers and it burns like crazy. But you know, you can rinse it off or use a neutralizer to get rid of that, but it stains your fingers this like bright yellow color. And I get really self-conscious sometimes when I'm making a video and I have my hands in it somewhere and you can just see like my, like a portion of my nail and then like the tip of my finger is this like, I mean, it's like jaundice looking. It just, it doesn't look natural. It's almost disgusting. I'm like, oh, I got to cut that out because I don't want people thinking I'm like starting to rot or something like that. Cause it's, you know, it's disturbing looking. Like my wife thinks sometimes it looks like nicotine stain. She's like, yeah, you've been smoking cigarettes. Yeah. I'm like, no, it's nitric acid. It wouldn't be on the middle of my middle fingers, like on the fingernail. If it was cigarettes, it would be like on the edges. But yeah, it's weird. And just the whole online culture sometimes, the comments people leave can.
Well, and just being in their head, like they all they can see is a dirty hands. They can't see the animal because they're just so distracted by normally seeing hands that are in advertisements or something. Or they work on a computer all day, so they don't have dirt under their fingernails from digging potatoes. So, and I want to understand them and engage positively and be like, thank you for your concern. I did wash my hands. But at the same time, it's like, really? Can't you just, it's a pretty mantis. Look at the mantis. I'm literally showing you bugs. You don't think I might have some dirt under my fingernails? Right. <It's> I'm not a cooking show.
So you also have a pretty big, you said like Instagram is your main focus, or I mean, would you describe it that way?
Yeah. Yeah. I tried to stay off most social networking stuff. And then I was in a environmental class where they asked us to do an Instagram account from the view of an animal. And so my first Instagram was Quail in the City. And it was just like, what do animals see as their reality? And then I just kind of turned that into my personal account. And then that extended into the Arthropod Ambassadors account, because I just want people to see the animals just up close macros, as well as just what it's like to keep them and them in a, you know, pretty settings, just to make them more appealing. So a lot of what I do is Instagram. Really nice community. Shapes of Nature and Tetraceris and Mantidology all are just kind of, they're some of my best friends are on my Instagram account. So, but it's just really fun to share that community and get that focus on just the photos and not so much negative comments that sometimes filter their way into the conversation and Facebook and things like that.
Yeah. I'm wanting to talk to the guy from Shapes of Nature and get him on the podcast as well, because I've sat in on a few of his live streams on Instagram. I know he's friends with Peter from Bugs and Spiders Cyberspace. It's just kind of like you guys have like your own little clique, kind of like how tarantula people have their clique and true. Scorpion people have their clique. So it's like I really want to kind of cross that bridge, get him on there. I still need to reach out to him, I think, and try to make it official. But if you're listening by any chance, you're more than welcome to come on the podcast.
Oh, yeah, Jesse's more than down. I'm actually wearing one of his shirts right now. He's got the I'd Rather Be Bug Hunting shirt. Ooh, give a shout out. And those are a bunch of his designs. He's done as single stickers. So his single stickers designs sit onto a shirt. But he used a lot of I sent him a bunch of photos of ghost mantises for his ghost mantis sticker. I took one photo and he like messaged me. He's like, can you get it at a little different angle? I was like, yeah, of course. And I actually sent him a spiny flower mantis so that he'll do that sticker. So I'm locking him down on it. He needs to make that sticker for me.
Very cool. I actually have one of his stickers on my desk right here. It's a tailless
whip. The Ambo Pygy, the best.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah. No, yeah.
I don't know where I'm going to stick. I keep getting his stickers. People keep sending them to me. I think it's mainly Bugs in Cyberspace. Every time I get a package from him, he throws some of his stickers in. Yeah. And they're really cool. And I don't want to just like put them, I want to put them somewhere special, you know, that I'm going to see them and appreciate them. And they're not going to get destroyed. And that's just ended up like, I haven't stuck them anywhere yet. They're just piling up on my desk. And
all of mine are, I got to figure out. I treat them like collector cards. I have them all as cards in a thing. I haven't been able to stick them to anything, but
nice.
And he's also, he focuses on conservation. He does a lot of actual animals, not insects. And then puts money towards, I know when Australia was having issues with wildfires, he did a Australia series and then all the profits went to Australian wildlife saving. So he's really active in conservation and conservation that's like smaller concentrated efforts. So condor research and things like that. So he's really got a great ethic going forward.
So if people want to check out your YouTube channel, it's just Arthropod Ambassadors, as well as your, Instagram, like everything. Your website is Arthropod dash ambassadors. Is that right?
Yeah, it was that thing where some things take dashes, something take dots. Like the email's a dot and the other one's a dash. It's whatever the format took. So you can't do underscores in a website name. So you can't do that. But the underscore works for Instagram names. And that ended up being the messiest thing about it. But for some reason, it's a name that hasn't been used anywhere else. So I got all the domains and all that.
I was having issues with that Because it was the, well, first it was just Tarantula Collective, but there's a, I don't even know how to, like, some kind of electronic music. It's not dubstep. It's more like house or something like that out of Brazil and or something somewhere in South America called the Tarantula Collective or just called Tarantula Collective. So when I started the YouTube channel, they already had it and they were much larger than me. So I was like, well, I want to differentiate myself from them. So it'll just be the Tarantula Collective. And then when I, you know, it turns out that within a year, my channel was bigger than theirs and they weren't even like, I don't even know if they're still together. Again, I haven't seen anything new out of them for a while. But at the time when I started, they had all of the domain, you know what I mean? Like everything was that I wanted, they already had. So, and I was struggling because like I couldn't just have the Tarantula Collective without the underscores on Instagram. So I was like, well, you know, I tried to keep everything the same and it just depending on what platform you're on, they will accept spaces or they won't accept spaces or they will take an underscore, but you know, others you can't use it. So I was like, there's no way to kind of make this universal, which is kind of frustrating. So I feel where you're coming from. But if people want to, you know, check out your website, you've got some stuff, what kind of stuff is on your website?
Currently it's just the Mantis care sheet that's focused on ghosts. And then my availability list that I try to keep updated. I need to do more pages. I'm actually building the website from script. So I'm not using a hosting. I should be using a Squarespace and not wasting so much time, but we're hosting it through the tech side of my relationship has it all on lockdown. So learning, and it's really, I kind of enjoy coding. It's a sick pleasure of mine. I like to be in pain and stuck up against walls and unable to do stuff. And then as soon as you break free, it's like, oh, I can make this text larger. And then you see another website and you're like, oh, that was so hard for them to do, even though they probably just used a platform.
Yeah. I started that with, my website was just, I was using WordPress and, like .org or whatever. We actually have to code it yourself. And, was overwhelmed, but I had a friend that was, he was actually trying to start a business, developing websites a few years ago. So he was pretty much was like, I will help you do this. Essentially what it essentially meant, I'll do this for you, but I got to be able to use it like in my portfolio, to show other people, well, this is what I can do so I can sell my services to them. And I was like, yeah, that's fine. He worked on it for about 6 months and, I started getting other jobs that were paying. So like, the priority for my website kept moving further and further down his list. So I was like, well, I got to learn to do this myself, and spent like 3 months trying to figure out what he was doing. And finally got so frustrated. I was like, I'm taking the whole thing down. And I just went to Squarespace and took the easy route.
Especially when you're coding off somebody else's code. Like if he's written it, you're trying to tweak it versus having written it yourself is very difficult.
and I don't speak that language. I mean, I think a friend of mine, his kid is at he's four. Jeez, I'm getting old. He's four now. And they're talking about what language, because his wife is Russian. So the kid's learning Russian and English at the same time. And, you know, I wish somebody was teaching me that language. But he's like, I don't want him to learn Spanish or Russian. I want him to learn code because that's the universal language. So he's like starting to teach his kid at 4 years old, how to do, you know, coding, which I think is pretty cool.
Yeah, the future is going to be different. And at least.
Well, I wanted to thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been very interesting talking to you, and it's nice to get to meet you, it's not face-to-face, but it's as close as face-to-face that we can get anymore. I look forward to one day, like, actually being able to do podcasts in person.
Yeah, I can't wait for expos again. I'm going to find you at Tinley.
Yeah, definitely. I can't wait to go back to Tinley. It's been driving me crazy, especially now. Like, well, the last time I was there, I think I was about to cross 10,000 subscribers. But, even at that, it wasn't, you know, it was weird because some people recognized me, but most people had no idea who I was. And I was like really looking forward to going this year, you know, with five times the amount of subscribers and videos. And I just thought it would open up some doors that weren't open last time as far as like getting interviews with people and stuff like that. And then it's just canceled. And it's like,
I had actually put together stuff for my first expo was supposed to be in March, and I had bought all the extra swag and little temperature things and some tattoos for the kids, and had upped all my species I had to be able to do a show. And then February came around and here we are. So I think maybe next January, but I'm not pushing it. But that's when they maybe will have their first one. And hopefully my application fee still applies because there's money on the table already.
Yeah. I feel you. Well, again, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And I look forward to hopefully having you on again in the future if this wasn't too terrible of an experience for you.
Oh, this was amazing. Like I said, don't put me in front of Patricia. I need that free therapy session again. So when you start doing repeats.
Yeah, I told her that she's going to have to be a regular guest just so I can benefit because my health insurance does not cover therapy sessions. So
everybody benefited.
Get you on normally.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you, Richard. I love your platform. I love how you view the animals. And like I said, I sent you the ghosts just to get amazing care videos once you've cared for them for a while. But yeah, just the photos you take and the way you represent the animals is really helping the hobby bloom the way it is. So thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And I plan on doing a video on them soon. I've got like a list of videos that I am trying to work through. And then inevitably, like my calendar is actually, I schedule it all in Google Calendars. So it's like 2023, I think is like, I have a video for each week all the way out into then. And inevitably something comes up and it's like, oh, you know, I promised this person I'd unbox whatever they sent me in a video. So then whatever that was, what was scheduled for that week, it's moved further on in the future. And some people get a little frustrated because it's like, oh yeah, that'll be out in like 2 months. And then it's been 6 months and they're like, where's the video? And I'm like, oh, I got pushed back. I'll have to move it, change the priority. So I'm sorry.
They'll have to make their own video, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. You've really illuminated some things for me and I appreciate that. And I'm sure everybody else enjoyed it. So make sure you check out Arthropod Ambassadors. I got their website and all their information scrolling across the bottom of the screen. If you're watching this on YouTube, if you're listening to the podcast, just go to arthropods-ambassadors.com. Or just search Arthropod Ambassadors on Instagram or YouTube and you'll definitely find them. She's got some amazing videos. So Aaron, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I really appreciate it. It's been a pleasure and hope to have you on again in the future. Thank you to everybody that's been listening. We enjoy it. We appreciate it. And keep coming back because I'll be releasing a new podcast every week for the foreseeable future. I don't have any plans on quitting anytime soon. I got a lot of cool guests lined up and a lot of topics to cover. So thank you all for listening, for downloading. You can find the podcast on any podcast platform that you use. And you can also watch the video versions that are usually uploaded later on in the day on the Exotic Pet Collective YouTube channel. So thank you all for listening and we will see you next week. Goodbye.